I asked you to read that John Doerr essay. What I'm wanting to communicate with the juxtaposition of the Rodney King video and the John Doerr essay and what I will unfold to you as what it represents. In a sense, it's the core of empathic argument. It's like, all right, you can get the idea emotionally in a specific instance of seeing something that you'd seen one way, another way. But to actually see how that would play out institutionally in a strategy of law enforcement that lends itself to peace rather than opposition, that's the story that is represented by the Doerr essay and that I want to see if I can clarify for you. It's really the story of Brown versus Board, in a way. It's like the fundamental story in American history on the issue of race. So here, start with Brown and think of what you're thinking about from the vantage of the Supreme Court of the United States. And put aside all of your preconceptions about the Supreme Court of the United States. Think of them as nine old people, and at that time, 28 kids. It's like these are justices of the Supreme Court, and they have a law clerk, or two. And who are the law clerks? They're kids just right out of school. And that is it. That's the institution. Nine old people with 28 assistants. All right, so they're from the beginning, you can see, an extraordinarily interesting institution because their power doesn't depend on force. It's like the court has no force. So here the justices are coming up to Brown versus Board, where they can see that what they're being asked to do is take on the issue of race integration in the United States. And they decide Brown, as you know, but they're scared, because they have no idea what's going to happen after. And so it's protected with these defense mechanisms. It's got a delay factor in it with all deliberate speed. It's got a requirement that the cases be brought individually. That is, you actually have to find a plaintiff, which in practice can turn out to be extremely difficult. They are to be brought against the school boards, and then the school boards are to make the remedy. That is, they're trying to make it as smooth as possible somehow, but they're scared. And it goes forward up to 1957, when in Little Rock, a school board put forward an integration plan, and Orville Faubus organized mass action. And Eisenhower was put on the spot. Actually, I'd love you, if you've all got laptops, I'd love you to go, I put it up on the wiki. Go to the Wikipedia site for Cooper versus Aaron. And just absorb it. absorb the story. Xander, you're unequipped. Come up here and do it on my machine.
All right. My laptop broke. Sorry.
My laptop is so limping, it's pathetic. So have you got the flow of the narrative? The court puts out this Brown versus Board, telling the South it's got to integrate. Gets no positive feedback from the executive branch or the legislative branch. They're just completely out there on their own. More or less holding their breath up into Little Rock. And the way Little Rock unfolds, and you can almost feel it as moves back and forth. He comes to see that the authority of law is challenged and moves in with troops. All right, so that's the background against which this John Doerr story is told. It starts with Jack Kennedy being elected president and Bobby Kennedy becoming attorney general. And Burke Marshall becoming assistant attorney general. Burke Marshall is an interesting character. I was on a phone call just this morning, reminiscing with some people about it. A guy named John Siegenthaler, who is the editor of the Tennessean, tells a story about Bobby Kennedy. Siegenthaler said that his candidate to run the Civil Rights Division was a man named Harris Wofford, who is a liberal, eminent man who had participated in support of Jack Kennedy, and that Bobby Kennedy said no, he couldn't possibly get past Senator Eastland, who was the Mississippi Senator, chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And in illustration of Kennedy's pragmatism, he said, I'll go with Burke Marshall, who was an antitrust lawyer from Covington and Burling, subsequently became a very eminent Yale law professor. And Burke Marshall then, when before the Eastland Committee, was asked by Eastland, have you ever given money to the ACLU? And he said no. And what have you given money to? He says, I gave $100 to the Maryland Democratic Committee. And that was it, he got through. And he turned out to be just an amazingly powerful character in terms of, I think, understanding how the law works. And John Doerr was just an amazing character in putting it into action, really understanding it. So basically the idea that Kennedy insisted on was that the federal enforcement authority be put in service of breaking the caste system in the South by winning for black people the right to vote. That's what he wanted to do. And hey, open them up. Come on. So, okay, you read this essay. What was the strategy? What was the message? What did they do? How did they actually produce it? Suppose you're imagining this, in a way, think of it like asymmetrical litigation. Think of it like, all right, you've got some pieces you can move around. Which ones are you going to move? And start with the premise that Bobby Kennedy started with, that he did not want to send in troops. The idea was, we don't want another Little Rock. We want to change the caste system in the South to open it up to the black vote. And we don't want to have to send in troops. So what do you get out of the essay? How did they do it? What were they up against? How did the problem look to them? Imagine yourself back to the time when Okay, you've graduated from law school. You've got your first job. It's in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, completely plausible. Basically, these were kids just like you. And there's not that many of you. Maybe it's just about a group this size. And you're in an environment that's not congenial to your mission. To some extent, within the federal government as well as in the field. So you can think of it in the metaphor of poker, looking at not such a big stack of chips. Who were your allies? Yeah.
Who's that student group? Sorry, I don't have the thing from it. It was SCCC, was it? The
SNCC.
SNCC. The students who were registering blacks in the South, and I thought that was their move was to associate themselves with them to defend them, at least in the beginning, rather than to directly to. He talked about the case where the guy got killed, but they couldn't take up a criminal case. But they could defend these students who were registering, who were, I presume, white.
Yeah, SNCC. Bob Moses. Chuck McDougall. Stokely Carmichael. Basically a bunch of young kids who were willing to go stop there. Put yourself in their minds. What was their strategy? What did they think they were doing? There you are, you're Bob Moses. You're a strategic thinker. You're out to advance your cause. You have the charisma to pull a group together around you. And now you choose your strategy. We're going to go south. We're actually going to go into the field. We're outsiders. We're going to come in, and we're going to register people to vote. Where should we go? Should we go to the cities, or should we go to the country? Or should we try and do it all? Where should we focus our attention? Exactly. Exactly. But I no, just pause on it. And consider this as a rhetorical principle. When you're trying to make an argument, to change a point of view, attack at the heart. Go for it. It's like Karl Rove. That's the theory. That's the rhetorical theory. If you can take on the strongest point of the opposing argument and stand up to it, then the rest of it kind of flows past you. So, for example, Andrew and I face the question with respect to this idea of projecting poker, whether where is the place in the presentation of poker for the idea of teaching poker to kids? Well, there was one line of thought that said, put that last. That's where the real sensitivity is. And there was another line of thought that said, no, lead with that. If you can be persuasive there, the rest of them are going to look simple. All right, so it's definitely a way of thinking about projecting an argument. And yes, Snick chose to go to the rural counties where they felt that that's where the racism was most deeply entrenched. You know, that's like the heart of the Klan. Yes, Andrew.
It strikes me that like the crucial element here though is if there's like a foundational element that you're standing upon. So in this case, they were talking about voter registration. At least conceptually, voter registration was something that was federally protected and something that people had a conceptual right to. Now, I mean, obviously the racism was putting up all sorts of stigmas or all sorts of hurdles along the way, discouraging voter registration, but the concept itself wasn't really in dispute. The voter registration, if they could get registered, was in theory something that was open to people and was there. I think when you're, like, a key element in projecting a message is the foundation upon which your message is based. Like, in the poker instance, when you're talking about, do you immediately attack at the point of most resistance, you know, at the core of it, or do you attack it at different levels or something? I think to some extent it depends on, you need a foundational base to stand on. And so if you can establish a beachhead, if it were, then that gives you the platform upon which you can thrust at the heart of the issue. So, I mean, I think that you have to assess on any given situation, if you're attempting to project a message, what do we have to fall back on? What can they not take away from us?
All right, well, you're totally right about that. And That really was expressed in the role articulated by the lawyers of this civil rights division. As they what was their relationship to SNCC? Right, and in fact, the role that John Doerr articulates for them is, you are officers of the law. You're not, you know, partners with SNCC at their mass meetings. Your job is to enforce the law. And the law that was being enforced was, just as you say, the right to vote. And in fact, their litigation method was to enforce that right just rhetorically to a fare-thee-well.
I think they were so impressive, so effective at maintaining the moral high ground in a very simple way, just without necessarily projecting it in a way that was offensive, but in just a, this is a right, this is the law, and we're just going to go do this because that's the law, and you know, because we believe in this. I think if you can use that foundation to maintain the moral high ground when projecting a message, it allows you the ability to always speak on terms that are favorable to you.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I was on this phone call this morning with John Doerr, and he represents exactly that, even to this day, just even through the telephone. Just immensely principled man. The things that he was most focused on beyond the strategic stuff was the commitment to the field. He had the statistics of all of the lawyers in the Civil Rights Division, how many days they had spent out in the field. And he had lawyers that had spent as much as 185 days a year, basically on the road in the South. And it was just it was just an amazing adventure. And the thing that's so striking about it was, well, all right, come with me further. Why, in what sense is it empathic? In what sense is the approach that Dorr articulates and that his crew of lawyers carry out, in what sense is it empathic? Say louder, Doug.
I think one small aspect of it, maybe not the whole approach, but they didn't try and take away the right, they didn't try and attack necessarily the, you have to understand a certain amount, certain parts of the Constitution. They acknowledged that was fine, they just said that the way in which it was administered was incorrect. And so perhaps you could say it's empathic by saying that they immediately accepted that the one part of the argument, they did try and create a universal system of, you know, everyone has universal kind of black suffrage just as is, they try to work within the system that's already there to make that fairly administered. And it was only later on that they moved towards.
That's certainly true. It's not a radical approach in any particular way, although there is radical legal thinking as it goes along. No one had ever brought statewide actions before. So the process of confronting what the problems were and actually accomplishing the goal confronts them with problems that they solve by making new forms, and that works fine. But yes, it's striking how completely within the system this is. It's like almost the opposite. It's like the use of the interrogatory form expanded rather than escaped. It in a sense goes with the flow of having to prove the case and taking advantage of the opportunity to prove it so that you prove it almost beyond doubt, even by the most stalwart onlooker. Yeah. All right, well, this, I think, any number of good lessons in the story of how the Voting Rights Act got passed. And it was immensely transformative, in effect. You understand, the key move was persuading Congress to eliminate education requirements as qualifications for voting. That's what it ultimately came down to. Because the states in which white supremacy was entrenched used the discretion involved in the legal judgments about educational qualification as the mechanism of discrimination. And persuading the Congress to actually eliminate that as a criteria before voting is what opens up the rolls. So I was actually in the time that I was at the division, I was assigned a county in middle Alabama called Lowndes County, and was the federal voting rights observer on the first election under the Voting Rights Act. It was a striking experience, including the fact that at 10 o'clock that night in the bottom of the courthouse, as one guy was walking out, he hit me hard with his fist in the solar plexus. I walked out, and I didn't see who he was, but that was a punctuation mark to my experience there. All right, so I wanted to take advantage of this to ask you for some help on a problem that is quite like this. And so I posted on the website the Farnham press release. And I had wanted to be wearing my Fine by Me t-shirt here today to fit with the press release, but it was in the laundry, so. Yeah. So take a look at this press release. Let me put it up so that you can see it. And then let me tell you a story about it. Here we go. So here, for immediate release, New York teen disciplined for wearing anti-homophobia t-shirt. And it tells the story of this young lady who gets sent home from high school for wearing a shirt that says, "Gay, fine by me." With the principal of the school saying that it was disruptive. She was advertising her sexual preference. Which she wasn't. So here's your problem. You're the tiny little board of a group, a nonprofit group called Fine by Me. Fine by Me is an organization that started a few years ago at Duke University when Duke was described as the most homophobic campus in the nation. And a few people on the campus thought that didn't seem right, that there was a tremendous amount of tolerance at Duke, and the problem was that it was just not seen or heard, so it was silent. And so they got a little student money and printed up some t-shirts saying, "Gay, fine by me," and passed them out in the quad. allows me to have to talk for a minute. And it gets to be a big press thing. Pictures taken, makes a big statement, the president of Duke likes it, has the administration wear them, the basketball team puts them on, makes a statement. And so a little organization forms, which has now passed out 75,000 of these shirts on different campuses all over the country. And this kid was wearing one of these shirts. But this is just a little tiny fledgling organization that would love to figure out how to project its message. And here along comes this story out of the blue. And the question is, how can they take advantage of it? How could you buzz this story? Well, you can see their thought is, well, write a press release. Who do they send it to? Where do they get the list? Who would even read such a thing? Who receives them? How do you do it? Andrew, you know everything. How do you do it?
Well, the way I would do it is, I'd, first of all, I'd identify a list of people to distribute a press release to. So I would go through and I'd identify both by Googling publications, media outlets, bloggers, people like that who are interested in any sort of interest that would relate to this. In my mind, that would be obviously like social interest organizations and blogs, newspaper, media across the country. It would be groups that are interested in politics and relevant questions about that. I would look for groups that are opposed to things like this.
So suppose I assigned you the job of putting the list together. How long do you think it would take you?
A week.
Take you a week?
If you want to be big, if you want to get started, take 2 hours to get 20 people on the list.
Uh-huh.
It's both easier and harder to find things on the internet than you would expect.
Uh-huh.
I put it in the Duke's college newspaper, either as by contacting one of their news execs or by submitting it sort of individually on their blog, and then try to get it onto as many blogs or slash dot, ideally, as fast as possible, because you don't want the story to be dead. But
right.
Duke being the place where this started would have natural interest in it, and it has a platform to get it out there.
That's
in a way that other places don't.
That's a real good suggestion. Kind of builds the identity of the story.
Absolutely.
Right.
I think also if you frame it as much of a like anti-homophobia issue as a free speech issue. So I think one of the most telling statements in the press release is even students who say they disagree with the shirt's message are outraged that she was punished for expressing her belief. I think if you came up with a second press release that played up the free speech issue, you could get some outlets who traditionally might not be interested in just like LGBT rights to publish it as a free speech issue.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Reframe the issue a little bit.
Well, with all these issues, you never want to be pigeonholed into your special interest group, right? I mean, you don't want to be seen as an LGBT movement. You want to be seen as a sample of a broader social question. Like, this isn't something that somebody can dismiss as, oh, this is another thing that, you know, the LGBT movement's gonna, and next thing they're gonna be talking about gay marriage or something, which is, people see that sort of stuff and it just becomes a buzz.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how do you make it like a coherent message? So then, in my mind, you have to reframe it a little bit. You have to be like, this isn't about the LGBT thing, this is about the free speech thing, but more than that, this is about that this is a young person who, on their own initiative, is wearing this shirt. So this is an LGBT thing, but really this is a youth thing, and this is something that young people are recognizing and you should pay attention to.
I don't know how hard it would be, but if you could get video of the kids having to like scrub off their arms with the, you know, like sneak a camera in and like show the teachers they can wash their arms, put that on YouTube, and like whenever you send it out, link the YouTube video so that people would kind of, you know, go to YouTube and watch it.
So, I mean, I would think the next step here would be that you'd go have a panel discussion and just skip it.
I'd kill it.
You just go and there, you just like get some students together. For sure, there's going to be some teachers there at this school who are willing to sit around and talk about it. If you can't do it on campus, do the administration's opposition, do it at a community center, you know, and you invite some journalists.
What? It's an interesting story. What's interesting about it? What is the hook in this? What is the hook in the story?
Yeah, it's just insane.
But what's, sorry, articulate. What is it? You have to write the one sentence blurb that goes on the box.
It's like that bongs from Jesus case, but better.
Yeah, you got one?
It would be interesting to have an experiment where people go over the straight Fine By Me shirt, right? Or write straight Fine By Me on their hands and see what the administration does. I think in some respects, having a panel discussion, the goal might be to provoke the administration even more. The more they do, the more ridiculous they seem, right? And so the story gets bigger and bigger and it starts snowballing. And I think that could be one strategy, sort of, you know, okay, like let's point out how ridiculous this is. Underground. And I guess it would take some organization of the students there, but if you could get that and then simultaneously alert media organizations to what's happening and see what exactly happens, that would be very interesting to see whether the response was consistent. By would they really tell kids to wash it off or just send them home if they wore a straight Fine By Me shirt? I don't know. Fine By Me.
It's not hard to get local media attention. If you just get like all your local cable stations or whatever, like your local like broadcast media. You got to figure out like three or four local affiliates. Somebody will come help. They'll send a reporter out in your local newspaper.
Start a Facebook group up too.
One of the things that's kind of absurd is that the person's straight. I mean, it's a straight person being accused of being gay, and like making them take off their shirt. It's like the kind of contrast of like a straight person being called out for being like provocative.
When there is the twist that runs all the way through it, she's straight, the message doesn't immediately come clear to you at first. It's a message that has you thinking about who the speaker is to be saying it, and what the speaker's headset is in saying it. And so it's interesting that way. And it's interesting that the message is a message of tolerance, and the principal doesn't get it to the point where they throw it out on the grounds of intolerance. So it's quirky. And the girl has character. She's feisty. And it sounds like she's got some friends that have character. So it's like a little social movement. You can get a little feel for that in it.
This also got a really sweet name. Heather with a Y.
So yes, you'd certainly like pictures, wouldn't you? You'd love to have the story told in a richer form.
But only if she's pretty. And not much. That's her.
We can take care of that in makeup.
Yeah.
Did you see the 19-year-old Norwegian girl won? What was the tournament that she won?
World Series of Poker Europe.
The World Series of Poker Europe. 19-year-old Norwegian girl who earned every nickel of her stake herself, starting with free rolls.
Yeah.
but absolutely perfect exemplar of amazing how the world produces these things. So here, I want to extend this gay find by me one hypothetical further. Poor Larry Craig. I mean, this guy needs a lawyer, doesn't he? He needs a defender. I mean, look what's happened to this guy. What was he actually guilty of? I mean, signaling in the men's room. He didn't do anything, just signaling in the men's room. And for that, he's vilified to the point where he has to resign his job, totally humbled, guilty. My God, he's just the scum of the earth. I mean, this is clearly an injustice. Now, I know, I understand that he's the greatest hypocrite that ever lived. He doesn't admit himself he's gay, so that one wouldn't be defending him. Perhaps his complete approval. But surely the world that's outraged had outrageous actions directed against gay people could see in this Larry Craig episode an immensely captivating example in which to put their argument forward. I mean, he's being punished. All of this stuff that he's being punished is because he's gay. And all of the people who might come to the aid of some wonderful exemplar of gayness are hanging back, because they're saying, oh, he voted against us on this bill. It's like stupid. It's like that money's already in the pot. This is live. This is right in front. And he's about to go down in flames in a way that completely locks in the whole structure of gayness and the modes of enforcement against it. So he needs a lawyer in the court of public opinion. I'm just wondering whether there are any takers here. I have to disclose an interest. I mean, the one thing to which you can respond to Larry Craig on, out of loyalty, and do so proudly, is that he was for poker. He was a sensible voice in the Senate for poker, I think. I think.
I hadn't heard that, I don't know.
Really? Yeah, I think he was, well, I may be wrong. In which case, there's no good reason to support him. Let him go down.
Expire at midnight, have to be voted on. It was the Safe Port Act. The next day, all the Republican senators chastised Frist for it, and they were just like, this is so wrong. Like, we have to support this bill because it's like an anti-terrorism bill and a national security bill, and you just added on like a huge amendment that will significantly change the life of 25 to 30 million Americans at the last hour.
So, all right, I'm going to give you an assignment. It's 6 o'clock. I want you to spend the rest of the class writing an essay to me. in response to well, I was thinking just Rodney King, but I'm perfectly happy to expand it. In response to the idea of empathic argument, I'd like you to do it in the form of an email to me and send it to me. Here, I'll do it in the form of a feedback memo. And this is the first subject. The second is anything you want to say to me. Just talk to me. Doesn't have to be anything, but anything you want to say. Good, that'd be good. I'm Nesson. At law.harvard.edu. You haven't got a machine?
Not today. I was on interviews till literally 20 minutes before I got here.
Uh-huh. How are we going to do that? Want to just go down and do it on the lab downstairs?
Sure. Sit in the basement? Never been there.
Take your beer.
My leave, do the same.
Okay, that'd be good.
It's about the principle, not about the
Thank you. I I So don't feel you have to stay till the very last minute.